This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
Are Chinese people oppressed?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question, and we talked about that before. It actually came up at a cocktail party I was at a couple of months ago in the U.S., and a anti-China hawk asked me that question, and I didn't give a very good answer at the time, but I thought, well, that is actually a really good question, because it kind of touches on a lot of different points. And I didn't give a very good answer because I didn't really have a chance to think it through, because there's no simple answer to that question. But it does bring up a lot of issues. First thing it brings up is, what does that really mean when we talk about oppressed? And the obvious answer, maybe the answer is obvious, but I think it has to be said, and that it means oppressed by the government, right? Mm-hmm. Would that be also how you'd understand it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the question is it, we can talk about, objectively, subjectively. And I think to start with subjectively, from the perspective of the average person, I would say typically people do not feel particularly oppressed in China. So that's of course really hard to pin down, because it differs from person to person. Obviously, there's some people who are going to say, "Oh, I feel very oppressed," right? But in terms of dissatisfaction with the government, I think for most people, the government's, there are always people that there are always gripes out there, but in terms of the overall, let's say, mind share the government has in people's lives, it's relatively low. And I say relatively, once again, implies a comparison to other places. When I visit, for example, the US, people talk about politics all the time, the government. It's their number one obsession. In China, people don't really talk about politics, or almost not at all. I guess they might talk about the government on occasion, but it's very rare. Maybe something very concrete, some very concrete gripe.
Why is that? Is it just a cultural thing?
Well, for one thing, of course, we don't have the whole song and dance with the elections, right? Because there aren't elections. Because I guess in theory there's some pro forma elections, but they're no real elections. Everybody knows that it's not a quote unquote democracy. There are no illusions there, which makes it a lot easier, right? I don't have to go through that whole rigmarole with its pluses and minuses. But I think one of the other reasons is because the number of people that are really dependent on the government for income is relatively low. So there are people that work for the government, obviously, and they are dependent on them, but the rest of the population, much less. And we don't have, China doesn't really have a welfare system in any way that's comparable to what goes on in the West. So people don't have that sense of dependence or entitlement. And I think the other aspect that plays a role is the fact that the government's sort of the general attitude towards the people, which is, we'll maybe get this a little bit later, but it's really to try and get people to solve their own disputes on their own. So if you have an issue, let's say a husband and wife are not getting along, and one of them calls the police and said, "Oh, he's battering me," or whatever, the attitude of the police is always, "Can you please solve it on your own?" And the same goes for basically any dispute. The police, the first action is always, why don't you two work it out? Let's say there's some conflict on the street. I remember once a case nearby where they had a fruit vendor nearby had tried to set up a cartel, and they were trying to fix the fruit price. They kind of succeeded, and there was this street vendor from Xinjiang who came along from the part of China where they're allegedly committing genocide. And the Xinjiang vendor was not on board with this cartel. So the Xinjiang vendor was always undercutting their prices, and they didn't like that. So at some point, I think they really went and beat up the Xinjiang vendor. But I don't know what was going through these people's heads, because it was all recorded on video. There were video cameras there on the corner. And I don't know, it was really stupid. But in any case, the reaction of the police was, first, well, why don't you just pay them some compensation, and then, you know, that'll be over with. That'll be it, right? And I think at the end, that's what happened. I think they had to pay like the equivalent of, let's say, $8,000 in compensation, and then it was over. And I don't think anybody was fined or anything. But both sides agreed to it, and then, you know, that was the end of it. And then also, of course, the cartel kind of broke down. But that's kind of the role that police tend to play in people's lives. And because of, there's not a lot of fear of the police in people, because police don't carry weapons, right? They don't do SWAT raids at 6 a.m. in the morning. So people don't have this type of attitude towards the government that you see in, let's say, places like the U.S., which is probably where you have to see the biggest difference in terms of Western countries. I don't know, what is it like in South Africa? What's the attitude of people towards the police? Are they afraid of them? Or are they?
Yeah, it's a good question. You are absolutely correct when you say you need to kind of define what you mean by oppressed. Because, for example, here in South Africa, you'll have groups of blacks who will say that they're oppressed as a result of the apartheid regime, 30 years ago. They're not oppressed by any sort of metrics. And you'll get women, feminists, who will say they're oppressed. So what is meant by the term oppressed?
Right. You really have to define the terms to start with, right? That's why I said, subjectively speaking, I don't think most people feel oppressed. But there are certainly people, you mentioned that case to me a couple of weeks ago, of that guy 15 years ago that I was the blind guy that felt oppressed. And he eventually, I think he was in constant conflict with his local authorities. And eventually they arrested him on some trumped up charge. And I think in the end, he was allowed to emigrate to the U.S. Well, I'm sure he felt oppressed, right? So there are always exceptions like that. I just think for most people, that's probably not a word that they would really know what to do with, because the government's role in people's lives is so limited. Anyway, that's kind of the subjective side of it, right? But we can also look at it a little bit more objectively. We can look at certain areas of what, you know, what constitutes a government oppression. I would personally say one area where China is, where people, Chinese people are very unoppressed, is in the financial sphere. And I would say that amongst the industrialized countries in the world, that China is the least oppressive by far, because China basically has a high level of respect for property rights in terms of money, and it doesn't interfere in people's financial lives very much at all. So there's no requirement to keep records of all your financial transactions, and very, very few Chinese file income taxes. The government has found no system with an app where you can file income taxes that can give you some money back. But historically, that's really never been the case. And they don't have a general capital gains tax here. So if you make money on the stock market, or you lose money, or you make money on crypto or whatever, they don't care. Like, it's just not relevant. You don't have to declare it. So people have a high degree of financial privacy. And that's something I think that's really missing in the West, at least in Europe and in the U.S. I can't speak for South Africa, but the lack of a requirement to keep financial records and tell the government whether you're making money or losing money, different things, I think I'd say that's very unoppressive. In terms of general property rights there, I think you have to compare the situation in China to other countries, if we're talking about objectively. One thing that China doesn't have, which most countries don't have to be fair, and that is civil forfeiture. I don't know if that term means something to you, but that's this system in the U.S. where the police can confiscate your stuff and your money without due process. And they say, well, you know, you have this money, and people that have cash on them tend to be criminals, so we're going to take the cash, and, you know, you can sue us if you want, but in the meanwhile, we're going to take the cash. That's how civil forfeiture works in the U.S., and they have to have some excuse, I guess, but they don't. There's no due process. We don't have that in China, obviously. We also don't have eminent domain. So the government can't just say, well, we think we want your land because we're going to build something, and we're going to take it, and we don't care what you think. Well, China just doesn't have that concept. So the government, basically, if a developer has a project, they want to build something, they have to buy people out. If you have a piece of property there and they want it, then they have to make you an offer that you can't resist. And because people sometimes just don't agree, you'll see these strange pictures sometimes of houses in the middle of roads because somebody just refused to sell. And then, well, their house is still there. It's kind of inconvenient to have your house in the middle of a road, but there are many examples of that. So once again, that in terms of property rights there, China, I'd say all in all, is pretty strong. In terms of one other area.
Hold on. But that property rights thing is quite important to this overall myth busting, because many people will say you actually can't own land in China.
Right. Well, that is a very complicated topic, and that is true. You can't officially own land. You own the property, meaning the house, for example, but you don't officially own the land. So it's a bit of a Jedi mind trick. What's the word for that? To figure out how that works. It's a bit bizarre, but the government, in theory, gives people leases of 70 or 50 years, depending whether it's commercial or residential property. But you'd own the house in perpetuity or the building. So I just, how does that fit together? It's one of those things, bizarre things that just doesn't make sense, right? So how can you have one without the other? I don't know. The problem with this answering this question is that it hasn't really happened yet. The 50 and 70 years haven't happened yet. So we're just talking in theory about what might happen. Well, in theory, the government has to renew your lease, and then you have to pay another lease payment. Of course, the reality is that, and the kind of the thought behind it, which in a way kind of makes sense, is that after 50 years, that building is not likely to still be standing. Something is going to be built instead. So what happens is when there's, let's say, the original office building or high rise gets torn down, then it gets replaced by something else, and then the new developer gets a new lease. So they have to pay again. So the government gets another share of the loot, and then you get another lease. That's how it typically works. Because buildings are not really meant to last longer than that. It's still a bizarre system, but you kind of understand the logic behind it. The problem with one of the other details of the problem is that what if you have a single family house, like what we have, for example, for which we in theory have a 70-year lease for the land. But what happens when you want to change it? And the government doesn't have a system to deal with that. So basically all the houses that were built here 15 years ago have all been changed because the building standards 15 years ago were very different and people wanted to improve them. So basically all the houses were changed, like most of them, illegally without a building permit. So this system is a socialist idea of this unchanging nature of buildings, which doesn't make any sense at all because things are always evolving, right? And the reality is that almost none of the houses that are now standing bear much resemblance to what they looked like 15 years ago when they were built, or maybe it was 17 years ago, whatever it was. So the whole system is kind of creaky, and it kind of works, it kind of doesn't work. But it's an evolving thing. It's a long, long answer to a short question. Unfortunately, there is no perfect answer. But there are a lot of people out there that say, oh, China doesn't have property rights. Well, that's, of course, absurd. That's the most important thing in China in existence is property rights. Everybody is extremely focused on property rights. I'm talking about real estate here, on their real estate, what they own, what they don't own, how they're going to, what the current price is and how much it's worth and what am I going to buy next, what am I going to sell. It's like the number one focus is society. So the people out there that say China doesn't have property, I just don't know what they're talking about. It's the main focus of Chinese society.
In comparison, the South African government, as you might know, recently signed a bill in which it can expropriate or take private land with zero compensation.
Right. That seems a bit difficult to square with the concept of property rights. And as we both know, property rights are kind of the basis of civilization. No property rights, no civilization. It just doesn't work.
Mm. And what's funny, though, is that, but what's funny or what's ironic is that China gets all the fingers pointed at, but we are actually far more severe.
Yeah, in China, I'm not aware of any cases of housing or, which is the right word, of real estate being taken without compensation. I suppose perhaps they exist, such cases exist, but I've never heard of one. It would be considered to be outrageous because it's absolutely the cornerstone of all wealth in society. I'd say that in terms of freedom of speech, I mean, that's definitely a valid aspect of that. And in terms of oppression there, there's definitely some argument to that. So I'm not, as you know, I'm not of the school because China is, I'm not of the rose-colored glasses school that China is perfect and we should love the socialist system and the West should learn from China in all respects. No, I don't think that's a very accurate depiction of reality. The reality is that China, in terms of freedom of speech, is kind of in the middle. I'd say freedom of speech, at least where we are today, it certainly is much worse than it was, the situation is much worse than it was 10 years ago. We had much more freedom of speech 10 years ago than we have now. But if you compare it once again to other countries, if you compare, let's say, to the UK, we have much more freedom of speech than the UK. But that's just because the UK is so bad. Right, they have no freedom of speech. Mm-hmm. There are people there. They've thrown thousands of people in prison for relatively innocuous comments online. In China, that would be unheard of. In China, it is. There are a few people in prison for things they've said online, but you have to work really hard to get in prison for something you say online. Almost always, what happens is you get a warning, or typically you get nothing. They just say, well, just delete what you wrote. And if you keep doing it over and over and again, eventually, what they might do is they might suspend your account. And then maybe eventually they might delete your account and you have to open up a new one. But in terms of actually sending people to jail, very, very rare. So once again, it's a comparative issue. If you compare China to, let's say, where we are in the U.S. right now, under the new administration, I'd say the U.S. is definitely in a much better situation than China at this point. Because we do have, as you know, some very ridiculous restrictions on the freedom of speech. For example, you cannot, in a public forum, you cannot mention the name of the great leader, and you can't even refer to him in any forum. And even say, for example, the respected one, you can't say that. As long as people know you're referring to the leader, right? Which is ridiculous, right? And it's so ridiculous that everybody sees it as being ridiculous. Even the police think it's ridiculous, but you know that's the unwritten rule. So
the other thing is you can't really do protests.
And we can do protests. They don't like that. They don't like people marching around the street protesting against the government. Although they do tolerate them on certain issues, and their protests in China are actually not that uncommon if they're regarding local issues. But certainly in a protest, you can't sit down with the government. That's something they definitely don't like. So they're kind of stuck in the mud there. But it is what it is. So I'd say in terms of freedom of speech, we're somewhere in the middle. China's still a relatively civilized place. There are no SWAT teams coming at 6 in the morning, like what they do in Germany. Also now it's once again in the news, SWAT teams at 6 in the morning confiscating people's stuff. That's just not how it works here. If you say stuff they don't like, what typically happens is they'll call your employer or your parents and say, can you please tell X, Y, Z to lay off and cool it. That's how it happens. And then eventually you might actually get a call and say, can you please come to the police and make a statement? But it's not, they don't send the SWAT team in. It's just different. And so that's another example of why people are not afraid of the government, because they think the government is going to be a little bit ridiculous, but not in the way that people are afraid of the government in the US or in Germany or in the UK now, because they don't have that atmosphere of fear. The government is coming in with weapons drawn and whatever, and it just doesn't exist. But once again, there are exceptions, and yes, we're certainly not. It is not in terms of freedom of speech. We're not up there at the top. We're somewhere in the middle. But that middle is, of course, not very well appreciated out there in the West at all, because you get at these extremes, right? And the people like me that try and give you the reality with this, which is somewhere in the middle, are also not very popular, because the people that are super pro China, everything's great, they don't like this type of statement. And the people on the other side that are super anti-China, of course, think I'm a shill for the Communist Party or whatever. That's their favorite. Their favorite statement. I don't see how. And somebody that says that their policies on speech are ridiculous. I don't see how that could be characterized as being a shill for the Communist Party. But they say that anyway.
Well, let's talk about that. The government versus the Communist Party.
People tend to, in the Western social media, they tend to refer to the government as the CCP, as the Chinese Communist Party, which doesn't make sense. They're two different things. There are organizations that are the party and that belong to the party, and their organizations and their positions and organizations that belong to the government. Most of them belong to the government. There are a few organizations that belong to the party, but most of them belong to the government. It's just a silly habit to mix them up. That's all. And it's, in a way, I think it's really the whole point of it is to be mildly insulting, to denigrate Chinese government.
Somebody who was parroting all the usual myths, and one of the comments was, the individual is nothing. One cannot do anything if the government does not approve of it. Is that true?
Well, obviously it's not true, but the question is what are some good examples to give to people to have them to make sense of that? I think that for one thing, it reflects a lot of cliches which have so little relationship to reality that it's a little bit hard to comment on them. It kind of goes back to what we first talked about in the beginning about the relatively limited role of government in people's lives. China has, we'll talk in a minute, but in terms of the overall size of the economy, approximately 75% of the economy is in private hands and 25% is in government hands. So if you're involved in the, let's say you're selling food on the street, and the government has a very limited impact on your life, and you know whether you succeed or you don't succeed is kind of up to you. And people can actually, some people, if you've done the numbers, you can actually do quite well selling food on the street. If you sell good food, then you can be definitely making the equivalent of $5,000-$7,000 net from the business being quite well. So I just think that makes very much sense.
And I know it's a myth, but it refuses to die, that there's some totalitarian social credit score in China.
Well, I think obviously that's kind of the elephant in the room, or at least it has been for the last couple of years, because it's been a really hot topic on Western social media for years now. In the last year, I've heard a lot less about that because for whatever reasons, maybe it's just that it's getting old. And I think now that the new government is in place, I expect it's likely to die on the vine pretty quickly because for lack of funding. the short answer is this term exists, and we had that discussion before with your friend Ian Davis. The term social credit system does exist, and it is a government slogan. It does exist. So he is right that the government slogan exists. But it doesn't exist as a reality on the ground. And it certainly doesn't exist in the form in which it's sold in Western social media. And I won't even say in the West, because it's not even really Western press that sells it. They kind of dropped that years ago. It's really more Western social media where that's on offer. Basically the gist is that there's this, like you'll see videos of people crossing the street, and you know, if you jaywalk, then according to some of these videos, then you will be deducted points from your social credit for jaywalking. And then according to some of the videos, there's a sign will flash, and then And then your name will show up because everything's, you know, surveillance and everything. And then you'll be automatically fined or deducted or something because of your transgression of jaywalking. That is, of course, complete fantasy. It does not exist. But it's a cute, they're cute little videos. Amazingly, people do believe them. And I guess one of the reasons they got away with that for years was because there were about 3 years there where there was very little traffic between China and the rest of the world. So they could kind of get away with that. And then the government, it was a CEO of some, I think it was one of the previous Hong Kong government CEOs who suggested to the government in Beijing that they should just open up travel and let people come to China without a visa. And then they could see for themselves how absurd the stuff was they were being sold. And since people started traveling, they started allowing people in for, I think, first 1 week and then 2 weeks. And I think now it's like a month. I don't know. I'm not even sure. But you can from most countries in Europe, certainly you can come to China for, I think, at least 2 weeks now without a visa. And since then, that whole thing has kind of died down because people come and say, well, that doesn't exist.
but also, Scott, it comes down to definitions also, because what exactly is meant by the term social credit? For example, in South Africa, if you want to apply for a home loan, you do get a credit check. That's essentially right. A social credit score of sorts.
Is it? Because, I mean, really, the implication as it's been sold in Western social media is that somehow it judges your political correctness or your whether you are.
Oh, is that okay? Right, I see what you mean.
And that's just. I mean, in China, obviously, we have credit rating systems as well, but it has nothing to do whether you jaywalk or what your opinions of the government are or whatever. It's just not related.
It's just financial
credit. These credit systems are all financial. There's no system. And then the people that rag on that are big on this whole social credit system storyline is they say, well, there was a paper in 2015 and some bureaucrat talked about this idea and then maybe you could do something. And there was this test in some village somewhere and they tried to do something. And okay, well, that's true. And there was some test in some village where they tried to do something, or maybe there are two villages. I don't know. But it doesn't have any new reality. There's no such system like in the fantasies that they've come up with in many, you know, different forms in Western social media. And if you go to the Western press, the only ones that talk about it seriously, they pretty much admit, well, it's not what it's trumped up to be. And there have been a couple of articles that have come out over the years. And even Wikipedia, which is really the paragon of political correctness, if you read it, it more or less admits it doesn't exist. But it's true. And like Ian Davidson said, it does exist as a slogan, right? And that's also one of the things that's a little bit difficult, I think, for Westerners to understand if you look at it carefully, and that is that China's full of slogans. The Communist Party always has a new slogan once every week about something or other. And I guess they get points internally in the party for coming up with new slogans. But Chinese people don't really pay much attention to the slogans. There's just too many of them. And often people make jokes, what is this new slogan? What could that mean, right? It's a bit of a joke. And that is just to say, this is just another one of those many slogans. And what does it mean? And what are they actually going to do? Well, it's who knows? There's too many of them out there. The only reality on the ground is that there is a credit rating system for companies, and they do try and make it possible to check to see if the company has been convicted of for example, not paying their debts. And you can check that. And that's actually quite easy to check online, the reputation of different companies. And you can also check to see if the company legal representative is one of these so-called shixinren, which means that they've lost their credit. And this actually gets to another aspect of this whole social credit system myth. And we've talked about that in a couple of the articles that we published on Substack. And that is that to sell this myth, they've interwoven it with a little bit of lies and truth. They've interwoven it with the a bit of truth, which is that China has this system of quote unquote punishing people that fail to fulfill their legal obligations to pay debts. So if you have a judgment against you, and particularly typically if your company has a judgment against the company, then sometimes they will take measures against the legal representative, which is sometimes the CEO, sometimes it could be somebody else. It could be the CEO's mother-in-law or whatever, who's the legal representative. And they will say, okay, well, this person, we think you owe money, and that we think you're just withholding it, you're hiding it somewhere. So until you pay the money, we're going to put certain restrictions on it. One of those restrictions is travel restrictions. So you can't buy domestic plane tickets. You probably can't buy international ones either. But you also can't buy high-speed train tickets. And people say, oh, that's the social credit system. The social credit is bad, so they can't buy tickets. Well, no. You can't buy tickets because you've been put on that list of non-payers. And that's they don't have debtors' prisons in China where they have the system to try and put pressure on people to pay. And so that does exist. And it's just not because of quote-unquote social credit. So that's often how these lies are spun. They take a little bit of truth and they mix it with something else. Oh, see, that's the story. And there are millions of people, and I know somebody that I can't travel because, well, yes, this system exists. And so one of the things you can do is in the credit system, the credit reporting system the government offers, you can check to see if the CEO of this company that you're thinking about working with or signing a contract with is on that list. Like, and if this guy is on the list and he is considered to be a person without respect for, does not paying back his debts, or the company's not paying their debts, well, then maybe you should consider about maybe not doing a signing a contract with them. So that's where that comes from. So yes, this exists, but it exists for a particular purpose. That's nothing to do with whether you support the government or whether you jaywalk across the road.
Well, speaking of companies, how tightly controlled by the state is the private sector?
Well, that's also, once again, the honest answer is kind of subtle. The first thing I would say is that according to the numbers, roughly 75% of the Chinese economy is in private hands. You'll get people online that make these absurd claims that the government controls all companies, which is absurd. I know that obviously from personal experience because I've been a what's the right word? A de facto owner of a company for over 20 years. And it's definitely not the government. It's definitely the government telling us what to do. That's one aspect of it. But the more obvious piece of proof of that is the Chinese government. In fact, one of the biggest problems they've created for themselves over the last, let's say, 5 to 7 years is they've treated many of their, let's say, champions, what should be their champions, their best companies, really poorly. So people say, oh, they're running all the companies. Well, if they really were running all the companies, why do they treat them so badly? Why do they fine them? Why do they fine them, in some cases, $1-2.5 billion for various crimes they supposedly committed if they were really going to run these companies? And the answer is, well, they're obviously not running their companies, and they treat them poorly. If you contrast it with that with the West, where you have a large percentage of the Fortune 500,000 companies certainly in the U.S. and Europe, effectively controlled by BlackRock, and BlackRock is in bed with all of the Western governments, and they have a really, really cozy relationship. Well, that's a pretty big contrast. In a way, I kind of think the Western solution is better, where they have this adversarial relationship with China. It's very damaging to the economy, where you have the government here and the China's best private companies there. And that's actually one of the things that's kind of looks like it's changing this month. There was a big powwow yesterday, or was it today, where they were, I think it was actually earlier today, where the government finally invited a whole bunch of the CEOs of the leading Chinese tech companies, which are all privately owned, to Beijing for a big powwow. And it's kind of a symbolic end to the years of cold shoulder that they've been getting over the last 5 to 7 years. Anyway, long story short, no, they're definitely not run by the government. However, it should be said the government has made a concerted effort over the last, once again, 7 years, more or less, to increase their control over some of these big private companies. So that's real. And in fact, they have a rule that if you have more than three party members in the company, that you have to form a Communist Party cell in the company. So you can imagine what the net result of that has been. Well, people don't like to hire party members. That's the obvious result. It's like when they come with all these rules to protect women's rights in the workplace, and you have all these things you can't do, and if women get pregnant, what's the result? Well, people don't want to hire women, right? Because of that. Well, same thing happened with Communist Party members. If you have all these things that you have to do with Communist Party members, then people don't want to hire party members. It's pretty simple. They have tried to increase their control over the large companies, like, for example, Alibaba. And they also pushed out Jack Ma, who was the founder and leader of Alibaba for many, many years. And he eventually moved to Japan and went to teach at the university there and refused to come back. Now it seems that the premier, Li Qiang, has finally managed to convince him to come back. So the tide has changed, shifted a bit. But there is that. That's real. They've really tried to take back control of some of the, or at least they've tried to exert more control over the private sector, and that hasn't worked very well. In fact, it's ruined business sentiment. It ruined business sentiment for many years, and maybe they're finally kind of something clicking in their head that maybe that really wasn't a very good idea to do what they were doing. So a long answer, but the answer is that there's a little bit of truth to that. They're definitely, they're always looking over the shoulders of these private companies and thinking, wouldn't it be nice if we control them? But that doesn't work, as we all know. And it's not, you know, if you look at who was invited to Beijing this week, who was making all the headlines, you know, DeepSeek, whatever, all these things are all innovations coming from the private sector. They're not coming from state-run companies.
Okay, but let me ask you a question about DeepSeek. That came from the private sector, yet. If you ask it anything about Taiwan or Tiananmen Square, it doesn't answer.
Well, one of the things it doesn't ask about is you can try asking DeepSeek who is the current leader of China, and it won't tell you. Well, that's because I told you can't mention the name of the great leader, remember? I mean, you can't get more ridiculous than that, right? What can I say? I mean, every country has their own ridiculous things, right?
Just to balance it out, ChatGPT has got its own propaganda, so it's
That's the thing is so one of the things you can do with DeepSeek is you can ask them all the questions you want about medical issues, because there are no restrictions on that. But in the West, if you ask about medical issues, you'll get stopped at every, you know, all over the place, because you can't talk about, and there's no freedom of speech in terms of medical issues in the West.
Yeah.
But in China, there is. So, you know, there's no 100% perfect solution. As I've told you before, I always tell everybody, if you want to search for sensitive topics in terms of the medical arena, go use the Russian search engine, the index. They give the best, get best results. But anyway, the point is there is no one perfect answer.
I guess a segue is the idea that China is this Orwellian state. We see that all the time. And it is true, isn't it, that there are cameras everywhere?
That's true. I mean, they're not everywhere, but there's certainly a lot of them. And the background of that is that there were all these terrorist acts in the period between, what was it, 2011 to 2015. And those were all sponsored by probably USAID and the CIA or whatever. And they were, a lot of people that were killed because of that. And then the government got really paranoid and said, we got to do whatever it takes to stop this terrorism. And so that's when they started rolling out these cameras everywhere. And since then, well, I mean, once they're there. Is that a downside? I guess it certainly does impact on people's privacy, I guess, to an extent, but it's not, I think that the video surveillance is not really perceived as something negative in China. And I guess it's because it's used in a very different way than it's sort of portrayed in the West. If you are on the wanted list and they want to track you, they want to find somebody, like you were seen, I don't know, stabbing someone somewhere. well, then eventually they will find you. Sometimes it will take a little time because the cameras are not actually everywhere. They're in some of the most important public places, but in smaller cities, they're probably not everywhere. It could take a while, but eventually they'll probably find you. On the other hand, if you're not on the watch list, if you're not on the wanted list, they have no idea where you are. So this is a complete myth. And the proof of that is they don't have any idea where most people live. So they're hundreds of millions of people. They have no idea where they live. The government doesn't know where people live. And you can literally live in China in places. And I know people for whom this is true. You can live in a place for 10, 20 years and the government has no idea you live there. And I have plenty of proof of that. They don't know. So there's no automated system to track everybody, what they're doing. It's only if they're specifically looking for a person, yes, then they have face recognition and they can eventually will find that person. But once again, that's not, I think people don't perceive that as a negative because it definitely reduces, for example, street crime. I mean, those people that beat up that Xinjiang vendor, I don't think they're going to do that again, right? The fruit vendors I talked about earlier. That was just stupid. I mean, the cameras are right there on the corner. What did they think was going to happen? I don't know what was going through their minds. So they're not going to do that again.
This isn't really a myth, but it's something you said to me a few days ago that I found absolutely fascinating. And we were talking about some of the unbelievably incredible engineering that is coming out of China. However, a lot of that engineering, for example, the bridge that goes between Hong Kong and China, is very impressive, but that's not privately built. That's state built. And there's an interesting dichotomy going on there, isn't there?
Right. Yeah, that's true. And then you can, I think it's a hard question to answer is, do these expenses really make economic sense? And I would, once again, I would tend to suggest looking at that from the Austrian perspective of Austrian economics and really from going back to Frédéric Bastiat, who was the French economist who pointed out when you're looking at any economic situation, you have to look not only what is seen, but also what is not seen. And what is not seen there is those resources could have been used for other things. So maybe these resources were used this way and there was a positive upshot, right? There's a return on investment. But what would have been the return on investment if we spent those resources somewhere else? And we'll never know that because they were spent here. And I think people, you shouldn't also dismiss out of hand these investments because the government has made huge investments in infrastructure, in particular in high-speed railways, in motorways across the country, tunnels, bridges, whatever. And in many cases, they'll probably will ultimately make economic sense. They will generate a real return on investment, depending on where you set the interest rate, how you calculate it, whether that would decide whether it really makes sense or not. But the government can make these type of calculations where it says, well, if we build a road here, well, the property value is going to go up and it will be also generate more. It will make the price of the value of labor higher, for example, because you can go somewhere else to sell your labor where it's more valuable. It will decrease the cost of distribution, all these different things, which ultimately make economic sense. And the government can say, well, you know, it kind of works out in the end. Well, maybe that's true. And so I wouldn't discount that possibility. But at the end of the day, yes, those resources are not being spent for other things. And that Hong Kong bridge, yes, it's very impressive, but it costs a lot of money and a lot of resources ultimately. So it's just printing money costs resources. And because of those, all those resources spent on all these wonderful projects, which are amazing, the many sectors of the economy have become very dependent on government spending. And as a result, the government is running a huge deficit. And the government deficit is resulting in money printing. And the money printing creates all these asset bubbles, which create all sorts of other problems. So, you know, one thing leads to another. It's not for free, right? These things, they come at a price. Who am I to say, is it worth it or is it not? Like you said earlier, it's because China has such a large population and does build all these things and has all these wonderful connections. It is possible to do these things. And it is impressive what they have accomplished. And the government is very good at reducing costs and keeping these things payable. And they also, their quality control job is not perfect, but it's okay. And they've had their share of issues, but they work on them. So it is impressive on the one hand. But on the other hand, well, it doesn't come at a price. So that would be my take on
it. Well, on that, One of the myths, I suppose, is the idea that everything that comes, that gets built in China and perhaps exported, is a cheap knockoff. I have a lot of technology in my home, and it's great, and it's Chinese.
Yeah, I mean, the stuff gets better and better, and there's and the reality is that if you're talking about consumer products, for example, well, China has the most intense competition in the world. I mean, it's you get the benefits of a huge market and absolute cutthroat competition between multiple private producers. So yeah, it starts off people produce maybe on the low end for the to compete on price, but at the end of the day, it becomes a quality competition as well. So you end up getting, well, as we know from the what is a good functioning market economy generally, well, it generates ultimately quality and low prices. So the stuff we can get, which is great quality for just absolutely pennies, is incredible. I recently was traveling and I ordered another little hand scale that you can use to weigh your bags, which it's physically attractive, very light. It can be recharged using the C interface with a USB, and including shipping, it costs like $3 or $4 overnight.
No.
I mean, it's just one small tiny example, but there's so many products like that out there. And so, yeah, if you're getting, in a way, it's a little bit unfair because the Chinese market is so much larger than all other markets in the world. And we have this tradition of competition of competitive producers out there. So it's really hard for almost any other country to compete in terms of consumer goods.
But what about the claim that it's slave labor or forced low wages?
Well, I think that's obviously a myth. The numbers are public sector say, oh, it's all fake. Well, that's silly. It's not the numbers are not fake. Maybe they're understated somewhat, but the official wages that are reported in China are roughly four times the level in, let's say, competing economy, manufacturing economies like Vietnam or Thailand. China is not competing on low labor costs anymore by any stretch of the imagination. On the contrary, China has over 50% of all the industrial robots in the world, and it's highly mechanized. China is an example of what Germany has also proven before. Germany has been the industrial leader in Europe for the last, 30, 40 years. They're deindustrializing now, but they were the leader for a long time. And they had the highest cost in Europe, the highest labor cost in Europe. But that doesn't stop them from being the center of the European industry. And the same thing is true of China and Asia. Yes, the costs in Japan are probably still higher, but the costs in Taiwan are lower than here. High cost of labor is not stopping from China from controlling the manufacturing industry.
Somebody messaged me a few days ago about that Chinese company where the people jumped out of the building into nets or something.
Right. Well, that is one of those old, what's that word? Stories. I think it comes from Flextronics. And that was out there 15 years ago, 20 years ago. Something about the nets, like you said. Well, one thing to remember is that Flextronics is over 100,000 staff. So I guess it's certainly possible that every year a few of them commit suicide. And maybe, I don't know what the nets were there for 15 years. Maybe it was because of that. It's possible.
Construction, maybe.
But, I don't know. But, you know, when you see stuff like that, if you've seen the amount of endless propaganda that comes in Western social networks that tries to rag on China of all sorts of things, you see stuff like that and you go, well, it's just more of the same. Could there be a little bit of truth to it? I guess. Certainly there are people that commit suicide in China. That's about all I can say.
Yes, a good one. The COVID restrictions in China were the worst in the world.
Yeah, that's one you heard for for a long time, and I think it's probably stuck in people's minds. But of course, it doesn't get talked about so much anymore. But people have these, there were these stories. I'll mention two of them. One was the welding people into their apartments. That was one of the stories. Another one was killing. Were they screaming? Was that part of the story? And another one was killing the cats and dogs. Those are the two that come to my mind. Well, the welding into their apartments. I do remember seeing a video about that somewhere. There was one video. I don't know if it was real or not. I guess it could be somewhere. Some crazy person, some crazy official did it. I guess it's possible, but it's probably fake. In any case, it certainly was never practiced widely. And if it were, it would be illegal. I mean, it would be in defiance of all fire standards. I mean, legality does exist, and there were laws that were broken at the time, but the rule of law is a concept in China, right? And if you, as an official, if you exceed what you're allowed to do, or if you, certainly if you have take risks like that, you're like creating, you're risking people dying in fires. It's kind of risky. You risk your career as an official, right? And if you get fire, then it's sort of, you know, end of game, right? So I'd say it's very risky to do stuff like that. So yeah, Chinese officials, or all sorts of officials, do all sorts of crazy things out there. It does exist. There are always exceptions, but it's certainly not the norm. And a good example of that is the killing the dogs or killing the cat story. There was one case that I know of where there was a dog that was killed in Shanghai, and I guess the people were off in quarantine, and one dog was killed, and it appeared in the Shanghai Daily newspaper, and it was severely criticized by everyone, and that was it. But in the West, they started the Chinese are killing the cats and the dogs. Right. So that's a typical example of how you have something that gets completely exaggerated. So to go back to the general premise is, yes, there were, the government did try to deport people to, which were effectively concentration camps of, supposedly people were either infected or at risk of infection. Some laws were definitely broken there, and that was, you could say there's definitely a loss of personal freedom there. Particularly in the cases where people were actually not infected, according to the Chinese law, the government had no excuse to take them anywhere, because you can only take somebody there if they're actually infected. The idea they might be infected or might have had contact, that was not sufficient under Chinese law to do anything. So definitely some laws were broken there. So on the one hand, yes, you had that loss of freedom, which was definitely, I'd say, by any normal standard of human rights, a problem. That's definitely not kosher. I was almost taken away myself, but I refused to go, and I got away with it and didn't go. Because I said no, I wouldn't open the door. You could get away with that if you were insistent. If you look at a different side of it, well, China at the same time was also the only major industrialized country where people actually had a right to not only refuse vaccination, but it was actually illegal to coerce anyone into vaccination in China. And that was the only country that I know of where that existed. You could say Japan, Mexico, they kind of had something like that, but it wasn't formalized in Japan or Mexico. It's like there was no actual law or regulations that it was illegal. It just, there wasn't as much pressure as there was in places like, let's say, France or Germany. But here there was actually a very explicit statement on the part of the government that it was illegal to coerce people, and that it was tested many times. So there was, for example, in Beijing at one point, there was one district where they said, if you haven't been vaccinated, then your kids in school have to be tested every day. And that was overturned in 24 hours. So you can't do that. That's coercion. And there were several cases like that. So in that area, I have to say China looks pretty good, because China was actually the only country that explicitly respected the right to bodily autonomy. Well, same thing also goes from masking. There was never a general mask mandate in China. Never. There were some buildings where you have to wear a mask when you walk in the building, but that was it. There was nobody ever fined for not wearing a mask on the street, for example, because there was no such law.
Just on the vaccine talking point, I know that there are a pile of Western countries in which various vaccines are mandatory. You know, you have to have it done on your kids or yourself or whatever. What's that like in China?
There is no general vaccine mandate, and it's ultimately the parents' decision. They can't give your children any vaccines unless the parents explicitly both agree. So in that sense, China has much more respect for bodily autonomy once again there. And in general, parents' rights in China are much stronger than in most Western countries. There's no system of the state taking away children into state custody. If there really is a big problem with the parents, children neglected, whatever, or the parents go to jail, well, then basically the response of the state is always to give children to relatives. The state is not interested in taking people's children away. And they have the same thing that goes for schooling, for example. China does not have mandatory schooling. You can do what you want. If you don't want to send your kids to school, then it's up to you. No one's going to force them to go to school. And you also know, even in places like in the U.S. where you have homeschooling is legal, you still, in most states, you have to report back and you have to do tests and so on. Nothing like that here. You don't want to send your kids to school? It's up to you. So you have much more respect for parenthood. But once again, there's a balance there. So a lot of schools do have, and the public schools do have, these vaccine requirements. So if you don't vaccinate your kids, you might have problems. Then you have to find some back door or whatever. And I have actually quite a few colleagues who are completely unvaxxed, and they all seem to manage to work it out somehow. So, you know, sometimes you have these, it's kind of typical for China, you have these contrasts between, like, with the COVID vaccine thing, just to be clear, China never had the mRNA stuff. So the Chinese vaccines were bad, but not anywhere near as bad as what was going on in the West. But the party, and specifically the party, not the government, the party, had targets they set for their individual party cells in various areas to get the vaccination rates up to a certain level. So they gave them these targets, but then they said, but you can't coerce them. You can't force them, right? Which is kind of, once again, it was a weird thing, right? You know, on the one hand, they say, yes, you have these targets, but then you can't coerce them, right? So some things, they just don't make sense. On the one hand, they say, oh, yes, you need vaccines to go to school, but they're not mandatory. That's China for you.
China's economy is tanking. It's not going to be the world's leading economy soon.
That's an interesting one. Yeah, tanking. That's obviously, that has kind of been what's been sold in many areas in the West. But also a little bit more on the side than directly to the press, you won't find that many articles in the Western press that say it that explicitly. But that is kind of the message that has indeed been communicated. As usual, our standpoint is a bit more subtle. The business sentiment is definitely very bad, and it has been very bad for at least a year and a half. And I think that the government is completely at fault. It's their own policies that have made that the reality, that have caused the private business sector to be very unenthusiastic about investing. The way many large companies in particular were treated, the unpredictability of government policies, but also what we talked about earlier, the reality that government has spent so much, they've dominated so many resources in the economy. It's kind of, you shouldn't be surprised the private sector has been somewhat reluctant because they're kind of getting edged. They're kind of getting edged out. I think that's definitely changing now. To equate that with the economy, what was the word you used? What was that? What did you say? Crash, tanking or whatever? I think the government has been overstating the growth numbers. I think they said 5%. The consensus seems to be more like maybe 3, maybe 2, maybe 0. It's definitely not, the economy has not done well. But people have to survive. And at the end of the day, China doesn't have a welfare system. So people have to make do. They have to keep doing stuff. And it's not, is the economy at a standstill? No, by no means. Stuff is still getting built. Stuff is still getting made. But are business people, have they been enthusiastic about investing in new projects? No. So there's some truth to that, but no, it's not the end of the world. Is China, you know, as the pundits would say, oh, you know, it's China's economy is as you say, tanking and it's going nowhere, and the U.S. will remain dominant around the world. Well, we published our numbers about that. The Chinese economy, by an objective standard in terms of what it actually produces, is about three times the size of the U.S. economy. Sometimes it's difficult to get for people to wrap their head around this concept, but the Chinese government can be fibbing about the growth numbers, exaggerating them, while at the same time underplaying the actual real size of the Chinese economy. And to put those two things together, sometimes a little bit difficult for people to accept. But that's probably the most accurate depiction of reality. The Chinese government is happy to sell itself as the second largest, sell China as the second largest economy in the world, which is just not true by any stretch of the imagination. The Chinese economy is far larger than the U.S. economy. We could talk about how you calculate services, whatever, but there's just no doubt that it's much larger than the U.S. economy. But that's not something they want to emphasize. They'd rather pretend to be, oh, you know, we're in the small, we're catching up, whatever. But that's just not true. And the economy in China has how many cities of 5 million or more? What, something like over 100 of them? And it's not true that the smaller Chinese cities are third world, you know, shitholes. No, they look pretty much like Shanghai does. There's really not a lot of difference. And there are 100 plus of them out there. So no, the Chinese economy is huge. And it's not going anywhere. And yes, the government has made some poor decisions over the last couple of years in terms of their economic policies. And they hit the brick wall in many cases because of those poor decisions. But I think that's, there's a self-correction mechanism that you don't have in the U.S. And why don't you have in the U.S. and Europe? You don't have in the U.S. because they always have China to bail them out. China keeps making up the difference, right? They keep pumping out the stuff no matter how much the U.S. and Europe drive themselves into debt. But China doesn't have anybody to bail them out, right? There's nobody that's going to bail China out of its stupid policies. So when the Chinese government makes dumb decisions about the economy and they hit a brick wall, they've got to fix it themselves. There's nobody else that's going to help them out. And that's kind of the positive side of it. They did make some bad decisions. They're not perfect. They've made some good decisions, some bad decisions out there. I don't want to fault them for all being bad decisions. Some of them were good decisions. All in all, the net result is probably better than what you have, was certainly better than what you have, what you've had going in the U.S. in the last 4 years. I think they've learned from their mistakes. So, you know, it is what it is. And things will go forward. But their biggest, what I would say, mistake is that they've insisted on this mercantile policy, this export-driven policy where they've kept the exchange rate artificially low. My take in that, so the Austrian take is that this policy does not have a future. It's not realistic for China to keep producing everything, all the products for the entire world, in terms of the manufacturing sector. There's got to be some sort of adjustment here. The reason that they keep insisting on this policy is because they don't appreciate the importance of letting the economy figure out the answer for themselves. They're stuck on this idea of central planning, even though there's overwhelming evidence that it doesn't work. And they're going to have to learn the hard way that they're going to have to let the economy, the market figure this out. The U.S. and Europe are not going to be prepared to continue to let China dominate all markets and make everything here and continue to accumulate endless amounts of dollar and euro balances to compensate it. This has got to be an end. And I think the U.S. government, the current U.S. government, sees that for what it is. And maybe they're not completely realistic either about it, but this is not a sustainable model, in my opinion. and that something's got to give here at some point. A little bit of an off topic there, a little tangent, but yeah. So yeah, long story short, the China economy is not collapsing, but there are some huge structural imbalances here which have to be fixed. It's not sustainable.
All right. So then as we come in for a landing, what do you foresee with the Trump administration and China?
Well, I think that the U.S. take is that this structure is not sustainable and they want to change it, which I think is good. I think that they should change it. And I think that at the end of the day, the Chinese government certainly has a strong preference for peaceful co-development, and they're going to have to find a compromise here. And all the evidence points towards the current government and the U.S. having a true desire to peacefully co-develop and peacefully coexist with both Russia and China. Some people say, well, they're making it up. If you look back, you know, China, the stuff was going on 4 years ago. I see no evidence of a adversarial intent at this point, regardless of who is in the cabinet. Maybe that will change. But their perspective about these imbalances needing to be corrected somewhat is a correct one. Unfortunately, of course, it's not so easy to accomplish. It's sort of moving the supply chains back to the U.S. is not going to be an easy process. So I don't know what they're thinking in terms of actually making this into a reality. But I do support the idea of working on these imbalances. And ultimately, it has to lead to a changed exchange rate. The exchange rate is not correct right now. We need a higher yuan exchange rate to balance these things out. At the end of the day, that's going to happen one way or the other. So unless something changes, there is every reason, in my opinion, to believe all evidence points towards an intent on the part of the U.S. to find an accommodation with China, at least in the short term, medium term. And China, certainly from the government's perspective, there's also all the evidence in the world that points to them being on board with that. They're not interested in an adversarial relationship. There's certainly been people in the past that have said, insert China as well, that they expect there to be ultimately a war between the U.S. and China, but there's definitely no such preference. And I think that as long as on the U.S. side they don't have that preference, I just don't see it anytime in the near future. And I think one of the reasons for that is because over the past 10 years, they have tried seriously to try and convince Western companies to pull out of China, reorient their production elsewhere, and they discovered that it's not so easy to do. You can give an order from the top and say, you will move your plant somewhere else, but it's not so easy to do on the ground. You know, it's these interwoven supply chains are really complicated, and it doesn't really, at the end of the day, just having BlackRock at the top saying, oh, you have to do this, is not enough. And we saw that with Russia as well. The supply chains are far less interwoven with Russia with China. But even that has been extremely difficult to do, to pull Russia out of that international interwoven connectivity. And in China, it's essentially almost impossible to do. So I think that there's a more realistic view of that now than there was, let's say, 5 or 10 years ago, and particularly during the Trump first term, where they thought, well, because in people up, most people don't, they think back to the Trump tariffs in his first term, but they forget that before Trump came on board, the Obama administration also would have made a serious effort to try and convince Western countries to pull investments out of China and invest elsewhere, and it didn't work at all. So then when Trump came along, they said, well, let's try it with tariffs. Well, that didn't work either, right? So at the end of the day, unless you make some real basic changes to the underlying structure, it's not going to happen. And I think that there's more realistic a view of that at this point. So in a way, that's good for all of us, right? Because if they accept that the world is so interwoven that we can't just pull things apart, well, that means that they have to find a way to peacefully work things out, which is good for all of us. So I think it's a good starting point. That's my take.
Well, then on that uplifting note, Scott, how can I follow your work?
Well, we've actually done quite little on Substack in the last year. I must apologize for that. But it's been a kind of a depressing year from business sentiment perspective. However, things are looking up now, so maybe we'll actually write some more about what's going on. Those interested can follow us on Substack, which is Austrian China, as in the country of Austria, but with an N, Austrian China, which .substack.com. And that really refers to our perspective being the perspective of Austrian economics, which is another whole story. What is Austrian economics? We've talked about that before. But it's the Austrian perspective of what's going on in China and how it's connected with the rest of the world. So yes, by all means, follow us there.
Scott, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thank you, Jerm. It's always a pleasure.
If you enjoyed this, please visit germwarfare.com.